From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm David Windsor. This morning, we're joined by best-selling author and gastroenterologist, Dr. Robin Chutkin, who joins us to discuss her new book, The Antiviral Gut, Tackling Pathogens from the Inside Out. Then, Nick Houchins, the owner and founder of A-Line Ski and Sport, a unique new service in Park City, mobile custom ski boot fitting. And finally, time management expert, Laura Vanderkam, who shares her new book, Tranquility by Tuesday, 9 Ways to Calm the Chaos and Make Time for What Matters. These guests, when we return, stay with us.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My next guest is integrative gastroenterologist, Dr. Robin Chutkin. She's been on the faculty at Georgetown University Hospital since 1997. And in 2004, she founded the Digestive Center for Wellness. It's an integrative gastroenterology practice dedicated to uncovering the root cause of GI disorders. Dr. Chutkin joins me this morning to talk about what she calls the antiviral gut, and that's also the title of her new book. It's about tackling pathogens from the inside out. Dr. Chutkin, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you back.
Lynn, thank you so much for hosting me again.
I want to start by asking, there are these trillions, literally trillions of bacteria and microbes in our gut, all leading to the health or opposite in our guts. We've got good bacteria, we've got bad bacteria. Could you explain, maybe give us a mind's eye view of what the gut looks like, taking those parameters?
Absolutely. So we can think of our microbes as the bees that animate our bodies, which are the hive, right? So we are really animated by our microbes. And what I mean by animated is that they literally are doing all the things to keep us alive. They are digesting the food. They are detoxifying compounds. They're synthesizing vitamins and hormones that we can't make on our own. They are training our immune system. They are turning genes on and off. So they are the little worker bees in our body doing all this important work. And most importantly, they are acting like air traffic control for our immune system, which is right on the other side of the gut lining. So these trillions of microbes are separated from the immune cells by a barrier that's just one cell thick, and that barrier is our gut lining. So you can start to see, Lynn, if the microbes aren't healthy and the gut bacteria lining there is compromised in some way, you're in trouble in terms of your immune system.
The gut lining is only one cell thick?
Yes, that's the only thing that protects us from the environment that we swallow every day.
So no wonder we have leaky gut is so prevalent and so easy to accomplish.
Absolutely.
Okay, so in your book, The Antiviral Gut, you're stating that all of this research really determines our body's ability to fight off viruses like COVID, for example. So it's not just about the health overall of us as individuals, whether or not we have a good, strong immune system, but it plays so strongly in the gut. Can you explain that?
There was a study from 2021 that looked at, it analyzed the gut microbiome. And so what we're doing there is we're literally taking a smear of stool and doing analysis on it to look at the various components, what microbes are highly represented, which are underrepresented, et cetera. And this study found that the composition of the gut microbiome was the most accurate predictor of outcome from COVID-19, more accurate, Lynn, than looking at comorbidities and age and even hospital readings like C-reactive protein and SED rate and all these other hospital tests that we can get. The composition of the microbiome was able to predict outcome from COVID with 92% accuracy. It was able to tell us who is going to end up in the ICU, who's going to end up on a ventilator, who is going to end up maybe dying from this virus. So that's the sort of valuable information that is encoded in the composition of the microbiome.
How curious then, because we all know people who, for some crazy reason, have not gotten COVID. I have an aunt who will not get vaccinated. She doesn't even want to wear masks. She's gone through this whole thing. Everyone around her has gotten COVID. She has not. It makes me think that her microbiome must be in really good shape.
Absolutely. Her terrain, you know, Pasteur coined the term germ theory, which says that a germ, a bad bug gets into our body and makes us sick. And that's absolutely true. SARS-CoV-2 is a germ, it's a virus, and it can get into our bodies and make us sick. But Antoine Béchamp, who was also another Frenchman, he came up with this idea of terrain theory, which says that if our soil, our terrain is healthy, like your ants, the seed, the germ in this case, can pass through our body without doing too much harm. And we've definitely seen that with this pandemic, and we've seen it with other viral outbreaks. We've seen it with bacterial outbreaks, that people who have a healthy terrain, who have a healthy soil, are much less likely to become infected. And when they do, they are not getting as sick. They're not developing post-viral syndromes. And so when we talk about terrain, what are we really talking about? We're talking about the gut microbiome.
Something you say in the introduction of your book that I really like. So it's less about the pathogen or the strength of the pathogen or the virus. It's about more about the health of the host. And again, when you say host, we're talking your gut health, your microbiome health. So there are several factors that play into having an unhealthy microbiome that you talk about in your book. And some of them are obvious, having low stress, good sleep, good diet, but there are other things that maybe aren't as obvious. You do talk a lot about low fiber being one of the issues, one of the problems. Can you tell us more?
Fiber is the essential food for a healthy gut bacteria. If we think about that study looking at the microbiome analysis predicting outcome from COVID, what we see is that the bacteria that is highly represented in people who do well, a bacteria called Fecalibacteria prausnitzii, or F. prausnitzii for short, that bacteria, highest levels are seen in people who eat a lot of fiber. Another component of a healthy microbiome, short-chain fatty acids, these are metabolites that are produced when gut bacteria ferment fiber. They produce short-chain fatty acids. Again, we've known from lots of different studies that high levels of short-chain fatty acids equal a healthy gut, equal more resilience, equal better outcomes. So again, how do we get high levels of F. prausnitzii and high levels of short-chain fatty acids? We have to eat more fiber. These are not things that we can just borrow from our vegan friend. We actually have to eat the fiber if we want these processes to occur in our gut that are so important for keeping us healthy.
So a lot of people, especially as they age, if they want to have more fiber in their diet, they take something like Metamucil or psyllium or whatever that is. What do you say about that? Because you do make a lot of recommendations in the book about diet.
I think the fiber supplements are great, but they are just that. They're a supplement. They're not a replacement for eating a high fiber food. And I'm glad you mentioned, Lynn, about as we get older, because one of the things that we know is that as we get older, we can get more frail. And frailty is directly proportional to what's going on in the microbiome. So when we see less species diversity in the microbiome, that is associated with more frailty as we get older. How do we increase our species diversity in our microbiome? By eating a wide variety of different plant foods. So that's a simple thing that all of us can do. 2018 study from the American Gut Project showed us that 30 or more different plant foods per week is a magic number at which we start to really see a healthy microbiome. And by plants, that doesn't mean just vegetables. That's fruits, nuts, seeds, herbs, spices, all of it, root vegetables. So important for all of us, but particularly as we get older and our immune response starts to wane and we worry about frailty, this is one of the really important ways that we can stay more robust and more resilient.
I want to talk a lot about medications because many people are on medications. And even if you're looking at what something like ibuprofen does to your gut, if you take it quite often, how does that weaken our gut?
Well, that gut lining that we talked about, that's just one cell thick, and that is the only thing protecting us from the outside world. Ibuprofen and other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs literally make holes in that gut lining. That's something that I see as a gastroenterologist every day when I'm doing endoscopy, and we see big holes that we call ulcers. Well, that's what a hole in the gut lining is. But even if you're not getting an ulcer from these drugs, you are almost surely getting these little microscopic increases in the permeability of the gut lining. And we know that this can make you more susceptible to things penetrating through, things like viruses.
So it goes both ways, leaking out and then leaking in to the
gut.
That's
absolutely right. Yes.
Obviously, long COVID is so prevalent on our minds, but looking at also the prevalence and the uptick of autoimmune disease, and it makes me think about how our microbiome is weakened also, and maybe that's a big part of the rise in autoimmunity.
In the 1950s, David Strawn, who was a microbiologist and immunologist really at the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, was tasked by the British government in trying to figure out why they were seeing skyrocketing rates of autoimmune diseases in British kids in post-industrial London. And he embarked, Lynn, on a 21-year study of over 17,000 children from birth to adulthood, looking at why these autoimmune diseases were so prevalent. And he found two really interesting facts. The first is that kids who were growing up in large households with lots of siblings and cousins who were coughing and sneezing on them. So kids who were sick pretty, you know, on a sort of regular schedule, the way kids are, they had lower rates of autoimmune diseases as adults. So there was something about, you know, this exposure to germs and being sick from time to time that was essential for training the immune system not to overreact to these germs later on in a way that could cause an autoimmune disease. The other really interesting thing he found is that kids who were super clean, who were bathing and washing and cleaning all the time, had higher rates of autoimmune disease. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't bathe, but it means we should think about this whole concept of being super sanitized. Our food is super clean. It's highly pesticized and processed. It's missing those essential microbes that are so important for our health. And we live in these very sterile environments where, again, we have limited exposure to germs. And while limiting exposure to pathogens like Ebola and SARS-CoV-2 is a great idea, we need exposure to all the other plethora of germs out there that are really important for training our immune system. And that's one of the main reasons why we are seeing such high rates of autoimmune diseases.
Mm. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm speaking with Dr. Robin Chutkan. She is the author of the best-selling book, Gut Bliss, and she's now back with her new book, The Antiviral Gut. It's tackling pathogens from the inside out. I'm curious about how fast this can happen, Robin. And here's just an example, and it's probably not a great example, and it's anecdotal and all that, but I had a biking accident in the spring, one that landed me in the ER with an IV in my arm, filling me full of painkillers. And then it was a fracture of a couple vertebrae. And so, as you can imagine, I was on some pain medication, you know, mostly ibuprofen and Tylenol, but a lot for a long time, you know, maybe a month. And in that time, I also got COVID. And now reading your book, it makes me wonder, can your gut be so quickly compromised that something like that in that short period of time could invite in COVID where I hadn't had it before?
Yeah, it absolutely could, Lynn. And I'm so sorry about your accident, but glad to literally be seeing you looking so intact and hopefully back on your bike.
Yeah.
So it's not just, I mean, the medication itself puts you at risk, but also the stress of an accident like that. We know that acute on top of chronic stress is really, really damaging to our immune system and our microbiome. So I would bet in a situation like that, that it's not just the painkillers, but also the stress of the accident that made you more susceptible.
Yes, that's a good point. And that's something that you talk about a lot in the book, stress. And like we said before, sleep, your amount of sleep. There was an interesting note in your book about how if you get a really good night of sleep for two nights before you get the flu shot, I think it was, you have a X number of, you know, better chances to have the efficacy of the flu shot be high. Is that, did I get that right?
You did. And it's true, not just for the flu shot, but for vaccines against hepatitis, against COVID, against all of them. And I'll tell you, Lynn, that was one of the shocking statistics to me also when my daughter was getting her COVID vaccine. She's a rower and she had regattas that summer and she was up late and I postponed it. I was like, no, you can't get it because you haven't slept well in these last two nights because you've, you know, been up at the crack of dawn for these regattas. And what we've seen in some of the studies is that vaccine efficacy can be reduced by as much as 50% in people who are sleep deprived. And then again, you know, we talked about as we get older, you think about an immune system that's less robust, sleep disorders, which are more common as we get older, stress, which can sometimes increase. And you see how we are really creating this perfect storm of disease. So the whole goal of this book really for me was a public service message to say, yes, we are living in scary times. We are seeing these pandemics. There's a study from 2021 from Duke that calculated the risk of a pandemic like this happening. And they calculated it at about 2% per year, which means for somebody born in 2020, there was a higher than 40% likelihood of something like this happening. So we have to understand that these things are not rare and that they are probably going to be occurring more commonly. But the flip side of that is there is so much that we can do to be healthier hosts, to be more resilient. And so many of these things, they don't cost a dime, literally. There are things that we can do. We can rethink our relationship to the medicine cabinet. We can really keep that goal of 30 different plant foods per week in mind. We can really tune up our sleep. We can think about our stress response. We can get out in the woods, experience some of that open air factor that we know is germicidal. It's actually killing viruses and making us stronger. So I love putting out these things that aren't expensive that anybody can have access to that can really make a huge difference.
30 different plant foods per week. That's a great goal. And what are your favorite plants for improving the health of your microbiome?
I love lentils, I love brown rice, and I love spinach, and I love combining them all. So a great meal for me is brown rice and some curried lentils and sauteed spinach. And not only do I feel my microbes sort of humming and feeling really happy, but really good things happen in the bathroom the next day too, I can tell you, with a meal like that. Stool nirvana.
Stool nirvana. I love it. Okay, that's good. What about people who are on medications like statins, for example? Let's take statins, for example. Is that something that's also going to compromise our microbiome? And I want to also get into the discussion about the prebiotics and probiotics.
You know, the good thing, believe it or not, statins are problematic for other reasons, but they're not one of those medications that really puts you at risk. Really, the top three in that category in terms of increasing your risk would be antibiotics, which we know a 7-day course of a broad spectrum antibiotic can remove up to a third of your gut bacteria. So antibiotics are at the top of the list. Proton pump inhibitors, those acid blocking drugs, a little purple pill, Nexium and company, those drugs block your stomach acid, make you much more susceptible to viruses, and also mess up your microbiome. And then immune suppressing drugs like steroids. So those would be the top three. And I mentioned several others. And one of the things I'm really proud about with this book, and I have to thank my team at Avery Penguin Random House for really pushing me to do this, is to go beyond just telling people what medications, but to ask, to give people the questions to ask. So for example, if you're suffering from an infection and you've been prescribed an antibiotic, question number one to ask the prescriber, is this antibiotic absolutely necessary? Question number two, is this antibiotic been prescribed to treat an infection or using it for an inflammatory condition where there's not a strong indication? Question number three, are there results from a culture or a swab that show this antibiotic will be effective? And how likely is this infection to resolve on its own without an antibiotic? And then possible alternatives. So I go through that with all the different medications, with antibiotics, with acid blockers, with NSAIDs, with steroids, with biologics, with hormonal therapy, so that it's really giving you, I mean, you can literally take this list to your doctor for any of these medications and ask these questions. When it comes to non-steroidals, I give alternatives for forms of NSAIDs that are less harmful to the gut. What's the dosage that you should try and stay below? So it's not all or nothing. But I really want people to be informed about how these medications, how the diet, how the environmental influences are affecting our gut and sabotaging some of these really important host defenses that are there to keep us healthy.
So you've had COVID, you have now long COVID, for example. How does that person repair their gut?
The studies show not just for COVID, but for other post-viral syndromes too, like for mono and for types of chronic fatigue syndrome that are linked to Epstein-Barr virus, for example, that these conditions are strongly linked to something called dysbiosis, which is essentially a messed up microbiome, an imbalanced microbiome. And so while healing your gut may not solve every one of your long COVID symptoms, it is a great place to start because the studies show that by having a healthier gut microbiome, you can improve some of these things from brain fog to fatigue to joint pain, etc. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to make you a healthier person in the long run. So it's a great place to start. Of course, there are other things that can be helpful too. There's physical therapy. There's you know, all kinds of, there's oxygen therapy for certain types of lung diseases that can be a result of COVID. So not suggesting that the gut is the only thing you need to pay attention to, but it's a really important part of the equation.
You had said earlier that all of the testing for inflammation and things like that that we might go through is really not going to tell us about the health of our microbiome. Is it just something that you have to feel, or is there some test that can tell us what we've got going on?
There is testing, and that organization, the American Gut Project, which is a nonprofit, is generally who I recommend you test through. But it's important for people to understand that we can't draw a straight line from one thing to the other. The same with genetic testing. You can sequence your entire human genome, but it's not going to necessarily tell you what your risk is. For example, you may have one copy of the APOE4 gene that's associated with Alzheimer's. That doesn't tell you you're going to get Alzheimer's. It tells you you have a slightly increased risk. What we know is that there are lots of modifiable factors for diseases like COVID, like Alzheimer's, like heart disease, like stroke. And those modifiable factors tend to be pretty similar. Our diet, stress, sleep, exposure to the outdoors, all of these things aren't just good for fighting viruses. They're good for fighting disease in general and making us healthier in general.
Just one final question about how we find the best probiotics and prebiotics. How do we find them?
Well, let's start with a definition. Prebiotics are the fibrous foods that feed our healthy bacteria, our probiotics, which are the bacteria themselves. And the best source of prebiotics are actually from food. So it's those highly fibrous foods. Think of beans and greens, and whole grains like brown rice and quinoa, oats, those sorts of things. Those are the best foods for our gut bacteria, the foods that are high in a kind of fiber called inulin, like leeks and onion and garlic. And so getting those things from food is always going to be a better idea than buying a pill or supplement in the store. And the same thing in terms of probiotics, you can get over a billion live bacteria from an apple that is grown organically in an orchard near you that's not traveling thousands of miles in a plane. So food that is grown naturally in microbially rich soil. And that may be true even if it's not organic. If the farmer maybe didn't have the resources to get that organic label, but they're growing this in a biodynamic, healthy way, you're going to get more microbes from that apple than you're going to get from a lot of these probiotics on the shelf. Eating fermented foods, we think about a food like sauerkraut. Sauerkraut can have billions of bacteria of different strains, up to 24 strains in a tablespoon of sauerkraut of different bacteria that are there to produce these post-metabolites, these sort of living medicines for you. So I'm a bigger fan for the average person of getting this stuff from food. Of course, there are specific probiotics depending on what you're dealing with. And I go through how to pick one and which ones do what in the book.
It's a great little book, such an important conversation. It's The Antiviral Gut, Tackling Pathogens from the Inside Out. My guest is Dr. Robin Shutkin. Robin, thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life.
Lynn, it's been such a pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm David Windsor.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
When it comes to skiing, a town like Park City pulls out all the stops and makes the best services available. And there's one new service that is entirely unique. Remember the days of uncomfortable ski boots? Since custom boot fitting has been around, comfort mixed with performance has become a reality. And now, thanks to a longtime custom boot fitter, Nick Houchins, and his new mobile custom boot fitting business, A-Line Ski and Sport, technology has been honed to bring to your home, hotel, or wherever you're most comfortable. Nick Houchins joins us. Nick, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What an interesting concept, Nick. I mean, if you're a big skier, you understand the length and time it takes to go get your boots fitted, and it can be hours. And so what kind of sparked this idea for you to bring this to someone's home?
Kind of during COVID, I had a lot of people calling me, wanting me to come to their house, Montage. So just after milling it over for almost a year, I decided this is the direction I wanted to go and started working on it in my head and on a piece of paper about a year ago today. Just finally made it come to life.
So walk me through the process. I know there's a lot that goes into it with, you know, the ovens and the grinding and the soles and all that stuff. So are you doing this out of a van, or are you kind of taking the whole thing into the house?
Nope, I'm doing everything completely out of a Sprinter van. I have the ovens, the punch, the grinder, even a router, so I can do alignment. So pretty much soup to nuts, A to Z, I have it inside of the van.
Well, it's an exciting new way to go. And obviously the higher level of service in Park City is always in higher and higher demand. For those of us who, you know, I'm sure over the years, both David and I have had, you know, several pair, if not in David's case, probably dozens of pairs of custom fit boots. You know, when I started skiing until I was probably in my mid-20s, you just got what you got. And you just put your foot in that uncomfortable boot. And then little by little, we started with an insole that they would heat up and then you'd stand on. The technology has really evolved. What makes it so expensive to outfit this van that you have with, and what exactly is it doing to read your foot?
So I'm using calipers, and I have a 3D scanner that I can use as well. So it takes a measurement of your foot and gives you the exact length and width of your foot. I'm a la carting it. It takes up a lot of room in the van. So I'm using two different methods. I'm using the 3D scanning method and using how I learned to boot fit with the dowel and just measuring your foot with all the old school tools as well.
What are the basic downfalls of a ski boot that we just buy off the shelf and put our foot in? Is this not capturing our arch? It's not capturing what else?
Most people don't even know what really size shoe they wear or boot size they wear. Just because a 10 shoe doesn't convert to a 10 ski boot, it converts to about a 26.5, 27.5 ski boot. So they buy the wrong size boot and their feet are moving around. So the best part about a custom ski boot is you can do the insole. You can punch the boot where you need to punch it. If you have the sixth toe that needs to be punched or ground, we can do all of that.
To piggyback on that, I understand for the comfort aspect of this, but if someone is, you know, newer to skiing and only visits Park City or a ski town infrequently, how is a custom ski boot going to help their performance?
From a rental boot, you got to think lots of people stick their foot in a ski boot, a rental ski boot a year, and they just get packed out over time. You don't have the choice of low volume, mid volume, high volume ski boot and a rental boot. It's just you get what you get and there you go. And if you come in town, you spend all this money, the last thing you want to do is ruin your vacation by having uncomfortable feet. And that's the best part about a custom ski boot is we can capture your foot. We can build it around your foot and make it perfect for you.
Now, you're not doing any of the technology that's used by other services in town where you're doing that foam injection and stuff, are you? You're essentially just molding that boot, heating it up, molding it, buckling it, and then punching it and doing the grinding. Is that correct?
Correct. I carry ZipFit as well. So it's a different liner. It's a cork-filled liner. instead of foam. I'm not a huge foam person. I think foam locks up the bone structures where you can't really manipulate your feet and get over on the edge of a boot correctly.
So cork filled, can you describe that?
Yeah, it's a cork they grind up and it's a gel matter. They put it all together and the zip fit has three different pockets. So one on the inside, one on the outside and the tongue. So you heat that up really hot, put it on and put it in the shell of your boot and stand in it for about 20 minutes as you're flexing it. And it moves the cork around your foot and locks you in pretty well.
Nick, I'm picturing you coming up to a house in your van with all of this gear and this technology, and how nice, especially because a boot fit can take a couple of hours. And when I've done it, it's nice the way it's done here in Park City, but I can really imagine just being in the comfort of my own home and that being really great. But does it present some sorts of, you know, challenges because people are by and large distracted when they're in their own homes?
So far, so good. I've had a lot of couples that come in and watch. The passenger seat swivels, and there's another seat in the back for the boot fit. And, you know, the husband or wife wants to see the whole process. So far, so good. Everybody's been enjoying watching the process and pretty much admiring the inside of a Sprinter van that's been built out to look like a ski cabin.
I would imagine that in the privacy of someone's home, there's going to be some more potential alcohol involved, which could help with sales. And, you know, maybe someone that wasn't planning on getting a ski boot is going to double down and get their own as well. But how long does this process take when you're going to someone's house? When from A to Z, do people have the boots or you're coming with the shells and selling the boot as well?
Both. I carry a few lines, but if you have already purchased your boot, I show up, may take me 5-10 minutes tops to set up. Start working on your boots right away, put them in the oven and go from there. And it's about a 2-hour process from start to finish. And then I pack up and leave and you have your boots before I leave your house.
What does this service cost, Nick, for someone who's looking to have someone come get their boots fitted at home?
It's definitely a wide range of pricing, around $1,200 to $1,500 that's the boot, insole, alignment, and all the work.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Nick Houchens. He is the owner and founder of A-Line Ski and Sport right here in Park City. $1,200 to $1,500. It seems if you get a custom boot fit and a great boot, how long are people keeping their boots?
A ski boot's typically 100 ski days, 100 to 150 ski days. So it kind of depends on the person that gets the boot. If they're skiing 50 days a year, they may get 3 seasons out of a boot. If they're skiing 10 days a year, you know, they're going to get 10 years out of a boot. But technology changes in that 10 years. So I would recommend definitely every 5 years, get a new ski boot. You know, it depends on how you store them. They'll break down. They need to be stored in a climate controlled setting.
Okay. Climate controlled, like very dry as it is in Utah.
And not hot. Yes, not hot. A lot of people in hot states will store them in their attic, and next thing they know, they've gotten their ski boots and they're just in pieces because they've been so hot. And, you know, it could be 2 years if you're in, say, Texas and you don't go on a ski trip every year and you have your boots in your attic and they've been 200 degrees for 200 days out of the year. It just deteriorates the inside of the boot.
I'm curious, you know, I'm always going to get selfish on my interviews within the show. And so I have a pretty wide foot and I've struggled with ski boots my entire life. I've gotten custom fittings, you know, like Lynn said, dozens of them. And for a large wide foot, what's the typical shell that you're going to put someone in?
A high volume shell. So every vendor now has a low volume, mid volume, high volume shell. And then we would measure the width of your foot and go with the high volume boot if you have a high volume foot, and then we would punch it around your foot. So we would make that, say it's a 102 lasted boot, we could punch that boot to 110 last pretty easy. Heat it up in the oven and put it on a press that's 2 tons or 4 tons per square inch. And when it's hot, you can pretty much move that plastic in any direction you want it to go.
So educate me a little further. What's the difference between, like, what's the volume of a boot, high, low, and medium volume? What does that really mean?
So it's always going to be the width across the ball of your foot. A low volume boot is usually a 98 last. A mid volume is 100 to 101 last. And a high volume is 102 to 103 last.
Okay, so no doubt, Nick, this year has been probably one of the most amazing years that any of us have so far experienced in Park City, where it started way earlier than anyone was expecting. I'm sure it has made you so busy already, but can it be a year-round business? Is it just ski season? And how are you retooling to maybe attempt to look at other sports as well?
So yes, it is primarily a winter business as we speak right now. I can build ski boots year round with it. And summer is hopefully time that I get to spend with my family. I spent a lot of time in the ski shop during all year long. Now it's kind of time to work a lot during the winter and hopefully hang out with my wife and daughter during the summer and kind of camp and travel the country a little bit.
Sounds perfect. So I know it's kind of a bad thing to say, especially in a week like this where it's just dumping snow and everyone's looking for a powder turn. I'm sort of a rabid Nordic skier, so cross-country skiing. And from time to time, I'll get a footbed made for my cross-country ski boot. But what do you recommend for someone like me?
I highly recommend getting a insole-made footbed made for your Nordic shoe, your running shoe. I mean, I can make them for every shoe. Highly recommend that.
Okay, so then the liner and the footbed are just two separate things.
Correct, yeah. So you have the shell of the boot, you have the liner that goes inside the boot, and then you have the footbed insole that goes in the bottom of the boot. And that's the one we have you stand on the bags, capture your arch, and cut it to your foot, and then we grind it to make it the exact measurements of your foot.
So, Nick, I'm just curious, what's the overall vision for this? What's your dream with this? Do you want to have multiple Sprinter vans and 10 employees capturing, you know, all of Park City all at once? Or do you want to keep this more of a boutique business with one or two people?
I have a 3 and 5 year business plan. 3 year plan is to expand it to at least one more van. And then 5 year, hopefully we are up to 3 to 5 vans in the Rocky Mountain area.
So you are looking to expand to different resorts?
Yes.
I love that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I want to ask about an intuition liner. What's the difference between an intuition liner and like a regular traditional liner with the tongue that you normally see on a ski boot?
There's several different intuition liners. There's the wrap version, kind of does a wrap around the front of the foot. They take up a good bit of volume if somebody does have a smaller calf and you need some room taken up. And they're a lot more padded. You have to heat that intuition liner up really hot to get it to form in the spots where it needs to be formed. And it's kind of the same with the zip fit liner. Zip fit liner, just intuition liner has a life shelf of 200 days, where a zip fit liner has a lifespan of about 1,000 ski days is what they say. So if you buy a new shell, you can take that zip fit liner and just continually move it to boot or shell to shell to shell.
Is an insole that you have in your ski boot, is that going to be able to be transferred, like you said before, from your, you know, to your cross-country ski boot, to your running shoe, to your comfort, just your walking shoe? That it's all the same thing, huh?
They can be transferred from shoe to shoe to shoe. I will say it's not the easiest thing to get out of a ski boot. If you've ever taken a liner out of a boot and tried putting it back in, for somebody that doesn't do it every day, it can be a little frustrating to kind of get them in and out. But yes, they can cross over, but I do highly recommend putting one in each individual sporting event that you're doing.
Right. And then finally, for example, I've got an AT boot, and I'm someone who holds on to my boots for such a long time because I still believe somehow that if you have comfort, you know, you can't have performance. And so when I have comfort and it feels like it's performing well enough, I keep that boot for like 15 years, which I know it's bad, but I don't ski 100 days a year at all. If someone brings to you like that, you know, they're stuck on this old shell that they just love, is that okay? Is it something that you work with? You sell them a new liner and an insole and go from there?
Look at the boot and you evaluate every single one of them. Sun breaks down those boots. And once you heat that boot up and that press that you use, this 2 or 4 tons per square inch, the plastic gets brittle. And I will let somebody know up front that we can maybe work on it. There's a good chance it's going to break, but I'm not going to break it on purpose. So you just had to be careful with an older boot and make sure that it can be worked on.
Great. Well, Nick Houchens, owner and founder of A-Line Ski and Sport, how can someone find you other than chasing you down in that blue Sprinter van?
You can find me at my website, which is info@A-LineSkiAndSport, or you can call me at 435-200-5521.
Well, Nick Houchens, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. Best of luck with your first big winter, and looks like it's going to be a good one. You may just not get in a lot of skiing. We'll put it that way.
I know. Thank you for having me, and a beautiful day we have here today.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. So you have a couple of kids, a full-time job, a spouse, maybe some friends you like to occasionally hang out with. So really, life is not going to ever get less hectic, or will it? My next guest is an author, a podcast host, and time management expert, Laura Vanderkamp. She's going to help us along on that journey. In fact, the name of her new book just makes me feel more calm and less hectic. Tranquility by Tuesday, 9 ways to calm the chaos and make time for what matters. Laura Vanderkamp, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
In some ways, before we figure out how to calm the chaos, we have to figure out what's causing it. And do you find in all of your work and research that a lot of times we don't even know what it is that's making us feel hectic and chaotic?
It is so easy to spend time mindlessly because it just keeps passing no matter what you are doing. We cannot slow it down. We cannot stop it. And so because of that, people can think we are spending all sorts of time on one thing, and then maybe you're spending time on another. I always suggest people try tracking their time for a week. I know that doesn't sound like a ton of fun, but often we have stories we are telling ourselves about our lives, and they may be true, they may not be true, but you know, if we want to change things, it's best to be working from good data.
Yes, absolutely. So what has been your journey in time management? Were you always good at managing your time?
Well, I've been better at different times than others, but certainly as the amount of things I was juggling went up, I realized I couldn't just rely on generally trying to make it through. I needed good strategies. So, you know, I'm managing my work. I have 5 children ranging in age from teenagers to toddlers. So, you know, always something going on with them. But I find that, you know, the busier you are, the more important it is that you have good habits in place that can help you manage your time and feel like life is enjoyable, right? I mean, we don't want to just feel like life is a never-ending to-do list, that we're doing what we need to for work, doing what we need to for family, but we never have things to look forward to. And so one of the things I'm always trying to get people to do is figure out how we can make life more fun, because if we're not enjoying it, then, you know, what's the point?
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm speaking with Laura Vanderkamp. She is a best-selling author of What the Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast. And her new book is Tranquility by Tuesday. It's 9 ways to calm the chaos and make time for what matters. Your book, What the Most Successful People Do Before Breakfast. I'm wondering if it sort of exhausted you, you know, to think, wow, what do you do if you're getting a bunch done before breakfast?
What did you find?
Well, certainly there are some longer morning routines than others. And I think when people are in the busy years of building a career and raising a family, maybe we need to be a little bit more realistic about the sorts of morning routines we can build into our lives. But we can still do something. I have a couple things I do every morning. I read a couple pages in a longer reading project I'm doing. This year I'm reading through all the works of Shakespeare. So I just need to read about 3 pages every morning. It's not too much, but I, you know, can get through it in 10 minutes. I do a little bit of writing, creative writing I do every morning. You know, it doesn't have to take an hour. Literally, we can be doing 15, 20 minutes of something. But because mornings are more routine for many people, if you build something into the regular run of show of your morning, it will most likely happen. And you can take advantage of that to, you know, have these habits that are advancing you toward the goals you want. That, you know, if you read something for 10 minutes every morning over the course of a year, you can read through something huge. It really is about just taking small steps, but doing them consistently.
These 9 practical rules for achieving tranquility you present. The number one thing, give yourself a bedtime.
This was one of the Tranquility by Tuesday rules. When I had people try it out over the course of the study and put it into their lives, their energy levels rose significantly. The proportion of people who said that they were getting enough sleep to feel well rested rose by 25%. Over the course of the study. So, you know, a quarter of the people saying, you know, moving from not getting enough sleep to getting enough sleep, that's a pretty huge shift. And you think about how that plays out, you know, people were able to do the things they set out for themselves to do in the course of the day. They were in a better mood. They had more energy for even having fun. Life is just entirely different when you get enough sleep. And people are like, well, okay, give yourself a bedtime. That sounds so simple. Like, that doesn't sound particularly profound at all. I was hoping for something more profound. It may not be, but when you do it consistently, I promise it is absolutely life-changing.
Simplicity is something that we overlook because we're looking for some magic solution or potion or whatever it is. And most of these 9 ways to calm the chaos, they are pretty simple, but you're being honest with yourself. How many of us really practice them? What is a resilient schedule?
Well, people can plan out perfect schedules where every minute is devoted to something, and then they get very frustrated because life does not go as planned, right? You know, things happen, emergencies arise, sometimes good things come up, you know, opportunities that you want to seize. And if your schedule has no breathing room, you won't be able to deal with it. Everything will just go off the rails. So I'm always encouraging people to leave more open space in their schedules. Open space is just great in general. If something comes up that's unexpected, you have a spot to put it. Or if it bumps another priority that you plan to do, now your priority can be rescheduled for the open time that you have. Anyone can create a perfect schedule. The true time management masters create a resilient schedule, one that allows them to keep moving forward on their goals, even when life doesn't go as planned.
Right, because how often do we get up in the morning and make a list of things to do and something goes awry and then we just abandon it entirely? And then at the end of the day, you feel like, oh, what have I done? One big adventure, one little adventure every week. Do at least 2 things you say that will be worth remembering. What do you do each week? Give us a few examples of those adventures in your life.
Yeah. So I every week try to put in 1 big adventure. So something that takes 3 to 4 hours, maybe half a weekend day, and then 1 little adventure, you know, something that takes less than an hour. You can do it on your lunch break, do it in a weekday evening, just as long as it's out of the ordinary. And the idea is we want to create more memories. We don't want time to just keep feeling like it's moving where we don't remember anything. We want to create memories that allow time to feel rich and full. So a previous week, one of my big adventures, I had gone into New York. I live in Philadelphia, so it's not that far to go into New York, but I had an event that was actually on the 101st floor of a building, which, you know, talk about an amazing adventure to see the sunset from the 101st floor of a building. And then as a little adventure, I sang a small solo in church on Sunday. I am not a professional singer, so that was a bit outside of my comfort zone. That was memorable. That was not something I will forget anytime soon, but you know, that's what a little adventure is, right? Something that's just a little bit different. And so now when I think of that week, I'm not like, oh, that was just another week. It's like, no, that was the week where I was on the 101st story. And that was the week I sang the solo. And each week can be like that. It doesn't have to be huge. You know, you're not going to Fiji. You're not going to exhaust or bankrupt anyone, but just something that's a little bit different. It changes the entire experience of life. Like, it's not just like, oh, I only have work and, you know, my other responsibilities and there's nothing else in my life. Like, this forces you to use the space that you do have. And I find that it just adds to people's energy levels incredibly.
Adding to people's energy levels. And as we have more tranquility, as we calm the chaos, it really should have that net effect of creating more energy so we feel less fatigue and more, you know, gusto with what we approach.
Yeah, I think a lot of times when people feel exhausted, it's not so much that they are physically totally exhausted. I mean, sometimes we are, but it's often that we need something different in our lives, that we need something that we can genuinely look forward to. And when you're not just feeling like every day is the same, when you're not just feeling like life is a never-ending to-do list, then you can feel excited about life again. Like, oh, you know, this is the week I have these adventures coming up. One of the rules is to do effortful fun before effortless fun. You know, so tonight I'm going to get to read in my book for a couple of minutes, and that's going to be really exciting. I'm going to challenge myself to do that before I do whatever else. And, you know, when we just make these small tweaks, we really can make life feel better.
You say batch the little things and keeping your schedule clear from unimportant tasks. How do we know what's unimportant?
Well, you know, we never know entirely what's unimportant and what is, but we can start to recognize those small tasks that need to get done, but aren't necessarily our top priorities, either professionally or personally. So, you know, if you're a parent, you're filling out constant permission slips or signing your kids up for something, or at work, maybe you're filling out a form for HR, or you're making a trip reservation or something like that. And yes, this stuff needs to happen, but it probably doesn't have to happen during your peak hours. Many people have more energy in the morning, not everybody, but most people, which means that when you get to work, you're like ready to go. So you probably don't want to spend that time filling out the form for HR. Maybe you want to batch those little things for, say, a small window in the afternoon.
That was Laura Vanderkam. You can catch the end of that interview on our website at kpcw.org. Thanks for tuning into The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Thanks to our underwriters, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. You've been listening to The Mountain Life here on 97.1 KPCW Park City. Enjoy your beautiful snowy day.